Wondering how to navigate local, city, state, or the federal government in order to grow your business, secure funding for your nonprofit, or advance your organization's agenda? Welcome to Lobbying Insider, a podcast that brings listeners to the intersection of business and government to provide a rare perspective on how things actually get done. We will dive into some pressing current issues, provide keen observations from the past, and keep an ever-watchful eye on what's coming next. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Glad to have you with us.
Welcome to D.C.
And we are joined by Jonathan and Jake from our federal practice here at DHC. Gentlemen, can you introduce yourselves? Jake, starting with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. My name is Jake Roach. I'm the Associate Director for Federal Government Affairs here at DHC, working out of the Washington, D.C. office.
Thanks.
And Jonathan McCollum. I chair our Federal Government Relations practice down in Washington, D.C.
Excellent. All right. So we haven't spoken to you guys yet on this podcast. I did want to get a sense of just what you do in D.C., who you represent, and what kind of issues come up. Jonathan, you want to start us off?
Sure. So we have about 50% of our practice is New York-based clients. We represent a significant number of nonprofits, both in New York City and on Long Island. And then we also do a significant number of legislative clients and work with companies across the board, from financial services to transportation infrastructure to economic development, really focusing on different legislative items and how those can benefit any particular client.
Gotcha. And New York clients who primarily will come to DC when Congress is in session, that kind of thing, you'll set up meetings and...
Yeah, that's a big part of it, is sort of being there boots on the ground. And then when the time comes and it's important to get that sort of face-to-face interaction, you know, we bring the clients down for maybe like a 1 or 2 day legislative visit, you know, schedule a bunch of meetings, cram them all together, get them walk in the halls of the Capitol, and, you know, really get them a chance to interact with their members.
I would imagine in some respects, we spend a lot of time in Albany, and it's very similar, right? We have, you know, clients who have a range of issues that they need before the state legislature. And, you know, at least in Albany, I would wonder, is D.C. similar to this? You know, everyone kind of knows each other. You know, once you're spending time in the Capitol and walking around, you certainly recognize most people. Is it a small world like that?
Yeah, it is. I mean, D.C. is a very transient place, so a lot of people are in town for 1 or 2 years, but the people that have stuck around tend to all know each other. And, you know, I worked, started on Capitol Hill working in the Senate. A lot of those same people that I walked the halls with are now in different positions, whether that's in the administration or in lobbying positions with other firms, but certainly a lot of the same people. I think one of the biggest differences between what happens in Albany and what happens in D.C. is things tend to move a little bit slower in Washington, D.C., you know, where some issues at the state level could potentially pass in one session. Sometimes issues take, you know, multiple sets of Congresses to actually work their way through. So, yeah, a lot of people work on a lot of issues for a long time.
You know, I couldn't possibly imagine anything could be slower than Albany, but that's an interesting way to look at it. I you know, I'm always thinking, well, not, it may not happen this year, guys. Albany has its own rhythm because there's kind of like a, you know, things get done as part of the budget, and there's a big kind of crunch, you know, in the beginning of the year. The session starts in January, and the budget's generally due at the end of March, although it often is late. But there's a flurry of activity to get things in the budget. And then there's kind of like the second half of the session, which is June, which is kind of any legislation that doesn't have a fiscal impact. Do you have kind of deadlines like that in D.C. as well? I mean, I'm sure, I guess the budget's due in October?
Yeah, the budget is definitely due in October, and you know, Congress really works with deadlines and walking right up to deadlines and breaking right through deadlines and ignoring them completely. So absolutely, the budget is due in October, and I can't remember the last October that it was actually completed in.
Right.
There's usually some sort of continuing resolution that pushes the debate a little bit further down the road. You know, this year we're dealing with a situation where the current deadline for funding the government is December 20th. That's just next week. They're absolutely going to ignore that. We're going to push this all the way into March of this coming year. So we're going to be working on wrapping up the, you know, fiscal year 25 appropriations bills halfway through fiscal year 25.
Right. And that's commonplace, you'd say.
Yeah. I mean, that happens just about every year. And, you know, everybody gets started, January, February, March, start working on appropriations bills, and the process gets underway. But, constantly we're looking at things getting delayed and pushed back, every single year.
Yeah. So tell me just a little bit about the earmark process and how that works. I understand it's been controversial. It's been taken away before. What how does it look now? What are they exactly?
Yeah, the earmarks, they have a fun new name, or two fun new names. In the House, they're referred to as community project funding. And in the Senate, they're congressionally directed spending. But it's all about the same thing. It's an opportunity for members to direct funds, specifically to programs in their districts, in their states, and sort of, use that power of the purse to interact a little bit more with their communities and, things that they think should be funded. So it's recently been brought back. We're on about year 4 or 5 right now. And it's an opportunity for specifically nonprofits, local governments, and things like that to, access this sort of funding directly through their members, either in the House or the Senate.
And it has a fun origin, right, where it came from the farms and they used to literally mark the ears of the cows. Was that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's I think that's the story. But
yeah, I thought I'd ever read that at some point. But yeah, but it's an interesting, yeah, they used to have member items in Albany, and then they kind of reformed it and called it something different, but basically the same concept,
Yeah, yeah, and it's, it's something that members take a lot of pride in, bringing money to their congressional districts. When we're working with nonprofits that are looking for specifically federal funding, it's a great avenue to go down, but you really got to start the process early, get the member to really buy into whatever the project is, whether that's, a process or funding a particular capital project, but get their buy-in early, work with them on the actual application. It's become extremely competitive. I would say about half of our clients have been successful in the process. We've secured millions and millions of dollars.
That's
for,
great.
For
yeah.
clients.
Yeah.
But every year, each of these members are getting more and more applications. And then, budgets are, capped at a certain level. So members might receive, 1,000 applications and only be able to fund, 10 to 15 projects at most. Even House members, it's less than that. So it could be, 5 to 10 projects.
And what about recurring? In other words, like if a nonprofit is lucky enough to get funding out of the federal government, like are they likely to get it again next year? I mean, especially if it's something that goes towards their operating costs?
It's a very good question. And it's an important question in terms of the process, because I think the way that they've set up these earmarks, the congressionally directed spending, they're really trying to, build something sustainable. So self-sustaining beyond the funding itself. When they are reviewing projects and they're reviewing kind of the impact that they're going to have, they don't necessarily want to see something that's going to come right back the next year and say, we need you to
need more
up again.
Right.
Exactly. So when we advise our clients, we're really talking about, they want you to put the structure in place of something that will outlive the initial earmark. And so it's important to sort of, craft the application or craft the potential project with that in mind, something that's not necessarily for salaries, for employees, but the structure, the infrastructure, the technology that's going to be there. Sometimes it is a capital project that then can, facilitate something longer term.
Would you say that was kind of your bigger success this year was securing funding? I mean, are there other victories you can point to where clients come out and they're very satisfied and get the result they want? I know how frustrating government can be for everybody.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. It kind of differs client to client on what their ultimate objective is. And certainly funding is a great way to, ensure a client's going to be happy with their representation in DC. If you're bringing back money, they're going to be satisfied. But we work with a lot of other clients that are pretty happy with the status quo. And so that what they don't want to see is any major legislative changes that are going to impact the way that they do business. And so oftentimes that work requires, it kind of goes on behind the scenes a little bit, working with members that serve on relevant committees, talking with them about legislation, certain provisions or regulations that might impact, their constituents or constituent businesses, and making sure that, no drastic changes are going to be made in any particular piece of legislation that's going to impact one of our clients.
And dealing, I guess, primarily with New York clients, it must be helpful, I would imagine, having New Yorkers in key leadership positions in both the House and the Senate. Obviously, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, who was majority leader. That's changing. We'll talk about that in a minute. And also Hakeem Jeffries, who is the now the minority leader from Brooklyn. I mean, I imagine in some respects, you know, there are clients who they might even know on some level.
Yeah, it's certainly an advantage that we have working with Senator Schumer's office, Senator Jill Biden's office. Same in the House with Leader Jeffries, you know, and the entire Brooklyn congressional delegation is really in a lot of positions of leadership. You know, there are a lot of members that chair various committees or serve on, as ranking members on various committees. So it helps. And, you know, being a New York firm that has a, you know, practice in Albany, a practice in New York City and Washington, D.C., we're really able to help clients at all three levels of government. And, you know, our New York members understand, you know, who we are and where we come from and the benefits that we're bringing to our clients.
And even having, I guess, a lot of our delegation be members of the minority, does that preclude them from helping and being able to get money and access and everything else?
Certainly on the, you know, the congressionally directed spending side, I don't think it really holds anybody back. It's been a pretty bipartisan process, you know, through the last couple of years. Republicans want to bring money back to their districts just as much as Democrats do.
Sure.
And so I think that in that sense, it's, you know, it's been an easy working relationship to sort of put these projects forward and things like that. It gets a little bit more complicated, you know, as you get into sort of the legislative side. Obviously, when you are, you know, in the minority, you don't have the control to bring legislation forward to the floor. You get a little bit less control on the committees of what gets brought up and what gets discussed, hearings that get scheduled and things like that. And so we have to work around that from time to time. And, you know, we have relationships on both sides of the aisle that we've cultivated over years. And, you know, we're able to, you know, get in and have access regardless of, you know, what the issue is, what the committee we're trying to, you know, work with is. And, you know, we've been very successful in that.
You touched on something that I think is very interesting, just in terms of the delegation. Obviously, New York is a sizable delegation compared to other states. And how is your sense of how well the Republicans get along with the Democrats? I mean, obviously, there's partisan politics. They have very different philosophies of governing. But in terms of is there enough common ground there that they generally do work well together?
You know, I'd call it cordial. I think that they try to work together. Finding common ground is sort of where, you know, we do see the New York members strive to do that. And we have members like, you know, Representative Garbarino and Representative Swazi, who are members of what's called the Problem Solvers Caucus in
both
the
Long Island guys.
Both Long Island guys. And, you know, both guys who see the need to seek that common ground. And try to work out the best way to get common sense legislation passed. So we appreciate the ability to work with both of their offices, and, you know, we appreciate the work that they're doing to try to find those middle ground issues that seem to, you know, be able to move forward.
Which brings me to the SALT issue, which I wanted to ask both of you about. Okay, I remember the state and local taxes is that you used to be able to deduct those local taxes from your federal taxes. So the tax burden, when Trump passed his tax package, I believe shortly after taking office, right? Maybe it was 2017. They eliminated that SALT deduction, and it particularly hit hard New Yorkers in districts like Garbarino's and Swazi's, right? I mean, Swazi has been a big advocate to try to repeal that and make that change. Is that something they've been working together on, and how do you foresee that shaking out in this next Congress?
Yeah, so tax reform is certainly at the top of the list of Republican agenda items. I think it's, you know, border security, energy production, and tax reform. And tax reform certainly is going to be the most difficult one to achieve because the margins are so small in both the House and the Senate. Republican majority in the House is 220 to 215, but that number is actually going to shrink with some of the recent political appointments that have been made. So really, moderates like the members on Long Island, both Democrats and Republicans, are going to have a significant voice in any piece of legislation that gets passed. So I think, you know, as the New York delegation comes together on an issue like SALT, along with members of the California delegation or New Jersey delegation, other, you know, areas that are particularly impacted by this deduction, they're going to be able to make a very strong case to have, you know, this actually included in the negotiation.
And what's your sense, Jake? I mean, is it something that people, you know, get populist about and say that it more, you know, more directly impacts wealthier, you know, residents in certainly in New York, you know, suburban, et cetera? I mean, does that work against it?
You know, I don't think it necessarily does. It's a talking point that, you know, other lower state tax states are going to bring up. But there are certainly enough Republicans in states like New York, in California, and some of these other high tax states that it's a real issue for them.
Yeah.
And like Jonathan said, with the margins that they're going to be operating with in the next Congress, you know, we've already heard Representative Lawler from upstate has made this an issue. And they're currently discussing, you know, what the salt cap is going to look like in this next tax package. He's bringing it up. There are other members that are bringing it up. And they're concerned, and they have the ability to really slow this tax process down until they're heard on this issue. So.
And the Republicans need those votes, right? Because of what you said before, Jonathan, just that it's a slim majority. You cannot afford to lose representatives. I mean, very often, I know when they pass legislation, you always have a few passes you can give to people who just say, for whatever reason, I can't vote for this because of my constituents. Mm-hmm. But they can't really afford to do that and give too many passes to their members. They need everyone on the bill.
Especially with an issue like tax reform, because you're not likely to get many Democrats on board to support something like, you know, that the Republicans have proposed with some of the corporate tax rates. And
this is an issue they disagree on. Yes, this is a very stark difference between Republican philosophy on taxation and Democrats.
Sure. So, you know, moderates are important. You can't afford to have any defections. But it also gives folks on the far right in the Freedom Caucus the ability to also influence how the discussions are going, because Speaker Johnson can't really afford to lose them either. So where
is there
the common ground? You know, where do you find those balances? Where do you reach out and, try and appease one side while also not upsetting the other side?
Right. And that's a very delicate balance. And I think we saw real evidence of that this year, right, with the leadership fights that they had in Congress. I mean, that was very tumultuous. Was that unusual? You don't generally see that, right?
Yeah, what happened with Speaker McCarthy and the leadership votes and some of the negotiations that took place with Congressman Gates and others, that was really unprecedented. Yeah. But, you know, a lot of those same rules are in place, and Speaker Johnson's got a very difficult job ahead of him to try and keep the party in order.
And what's your sense of that in terms of his ability to do that? I mean, I guess to the point we're making, when it gets even smaller, it's that much more difficult to herd, right?
I think that the situation that played out with the leadership votes is sort of predictive of what we could be seeing in, you know, the next couple of months and the next couple of years, as they do try to pass this legislation with really thin, you know, margins for error, not a lot of passes to give out. I think that Speaker Johnson's position is a little safer. They've changed the rules a little bit to increase the number of members needed to call for the vote to remove him.
Okay.
So I think in terms of, you know, the structure of the party leadership, he's in a better position. But then in terms of, you know, sort of bringing the whole coalition together, you're going to see a lot of the same fights, as Jonathan was just saying, you know, of the two sides of the party kind of having differing ideas on how to move forward, but not being able to move forward without everybody together.
Would you say both parties have similar divisions? I mean, obviously there's a lot of talk about the Democrats and trying to find the center, but then they're worried about their left wing. And, you know, many made the argument that they should tack left a little bit in this past national election, but then it turns out that the left kind of stayed home anyway. So I'm just curious, do you see the same kind of divisions within the Democratic Party? Obviously, it's a more hyper-partisan environment overall. And is that because of those outside pressures within their own ranks?
You know, I think in the last few years, we've been seeing the Democrats vote a little bit more together than the Republicans have. But I think that the Republicans have just sort of had the spotlight on them in terms of the leadership struggles and, you know, the recent sort of, you know, lines that have been drawn between, you know, the different flanks of the party. So you see the Democrats consistently coming together to vote for Hakeem Jeffries as the minority leader, you know, over the last few years through the leadership, you know, votes and things like that. So there are divisions. There are similar divisions. I think the Republican process is just being played out in the spotlight a little bit more.
Gotcha. And having Trump in the White House, do you think that instills more party discipline within the Republican Party just because he's the real leader of the party and that they're more inclined to listen to him if it's his, you know, package or tax deal or whatever it is he's trying to get through Congress?
Yeah, I mean, Trump had a pretty decisive victory and was able to, you know, carry a lot of these members of Congress to their victories as well. So they're going to be listening to what Trump says, and he's certainly going to have an influence more so in the House than in the Senate. You know, there are Senate's just recently had their leadership elections and elected John Thune, who's a fairly moderate member from South Dakota, to be the next majority leader. He's more of an institutionalist and a strict follower of the Constitution. So I think he's going to be able to put a few checks in the pace of what Trump wants to do. But, you know, Trump's voice will really carry, how this Congress shapes up.
It's interesting. You know, you hear from people who kind of observe the government that they do believe having someone like Trump in the White House with such an influence of, you know, tech billionaires and others who understand economics, that you could see a real supercharge of our economy over the next 4 years. I'm curious your take on that. And do you anticipate budget cuts or do you think that you know, spending is going to continue to grow?
I think the goal initially is budget cuts. I think that they do want to, you know, obviously they want to pass their tax package. And in order to do that, they're going to have to offset some of these, you know, the funding deficits there. And so I think that the plan is to look for areas that they can cut back on. And I think they'll, you know, bump up against this sort of check in the Senate specifically as they're going through the process to legislatively make these cuts in the appropriations, you know, in the appropriations process. You know, what do the senators feel comfortable cutting and how far along does it go? Does he get everything that he wants? It remains to be seen. And I think we're going to sort of watch it play out. If the moderating forces like the new majority leader, you know, can sort of slow things down and say, well, wait a minute, we may not see as dramatic of cuts, but it's, you know, it's a little too early to predict still. I think we're feeling it out still.
It always sounds good to make cuts. You're going to, you know, cut the deficit in half and you're going to do all of these things and we're going to grow our way out of the current debt that we're in. But then when you start actually looking at what programs you're going to cut, there inevitably is going to be a member, whether it's on in your party or in the other party, that benefits from that program, and they're not going to want to see it cut. And so an example of that is like when we're looking at some of the programs that have been included in the Inflation Reduction Act, and the green energy tax incentives and the EV tax incentives that are part of that plan. A lot of the manufacturing that's taking place is taking place in Republican states. And so when we talk about, are we going to roll back some of those EV tax credits or green energy tax credits, you know, it's Republicans that are going to be hurt by that. And so they're the ones voicing, well, let's slow down on looking at these budget cuts. So it's always a little bit more difficult to figure out how to pay for things. But that is a debate, you know, with this new Doge, Elon Musk agency and what they're trying to do. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, how that plays out.
You know, 30 years ago, someone wrote a book called Reinventing Government, and it was the Democrats. It was Al Gore who was put in charge of that as the vice president to kind of find efficiencies and, you know, why should government function the way it is? And then, you know, it just kind of quietly went away. You know, that it's just when it comes time to actually making the cuts and you realize that it actually is a little bit leaner than they even thought. And it's real jobs. You know, I remember you go back to the Cold War politics that they were manufacturing, you know, military equipment in all these states. People start to say, well, hang on, not mine. Why are you going to cut mine and not his?
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess it gets tricky.
It's really hard to undo something once it's already, you know, in place. It's hard to unwrite a law. It's hard to take back funding. It really is. And it gets down to sort of the granular level. You're right. Everybody is benefiting from this in some way, and it's hard to pick apart.
So they talk a lot about, you know, reinventing and cutting back and kind of reorganizing government. I mean, do you think they're going to come up against the same issues of pushback when they try to actually do that? I mean, you do have a lot of people from outside Washington looking at Washington, right, and talking about how they can do this and make these changes. But, you know, to the point, it's a lot harder than it sounds. You know, in a campaign, when you actually start have to govern and do it, it's more difficult.
Yeah, for most significant changes, like removing the Department of Education or, you know, some of these drastic cuts or moving programs, cutting programs, it's going to take Congress in order to do that. And, you know, with the filibuster in place in the Senate, you know, it's going to be a 60-vote requirement on most pieces of legislation in order to move. And I don't think there's 60 votes for some of the more radical ideas. I think, you know, across the board, people can agree that there's a lot of wasteful spending that takes place in Washington. But then, as we discussed, you know, what programs are you actually going to cut? And, you know, it's probably not going to be as quick as some of the people on the outside expect, you know, these changes to go into place.
The government is designed to move slowly, right?
Correct.
And that makes it very difficult to dismantle for, you know, after something that's been built up for years.
Yeah. And Senator Thune has been somebody that, you know, has said that he's not going to touch filibuster reform, and really believes in the way the process works and the importance of the Senate, and will not be, you know, one to back down from Trump trying to use the bully pulpit to try and push these things through.
I did want you both to comment just on the dynamic, which it seems like it's really the Republican Senate, the incoming Republican Senate, that is going to be kind of the check on the president. I mean, we see it starting off with the nominees. You know, there was a little bit of resistance to some of Trump's early nominees. One of the Matt Gaetz already dropped out, withdrew his nomination. So that just talk about that dynamic, if you could, that Senate Republicans are going to be in a position of you know, telling the president in some cases, hey, we're not doing that.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of moderate Republicans in the Senate that are, you know, worry about their own reelection, and maybe aligning themselves so closely with Trump is not the most political savvy move. So you have more moderates like Susan Collins out of Maine, Lisa Murkowski out of Alaska, and others that are not afraid to kind of stand in the way and speak on behalf of their constituents. And when they see something wrong, can really put a check. And with the thin majorities in both the House and the Senate, it's members like that that could, you know, slow things down.
I certainly think they're going to pick their battles.
Right.
You know, you figure out, you know, what means more to sort of stand up on. You know, you see with the confirmations, they've already, you know, put their foot down on a few of the nominees. But then at the same time, you've got some of the you know, potential pardons that are being discussed that, you know, they said they're not going to stand in the way of. So it's really about, you know, picking and choosing, you know, where they can be active, where they can say, this is how we want to do things. I think it starts as early as with the leadership race. You know, when they did elect Senator Thune, there was a candidate that was backed by the president-elect, and he didn't do so well.
He didn't do well. Yeah. Right, right. You mentioned, Jonathan, just, you know, some of the driving issues of the election. Do you think that's going to be front and center on Trump's agenda? Obviously, the border being one of them, affordability being a really big one as well.
Yeah, I think border security will be probably one of the first items that Congress looks to tackle. I know that, along with energy production, have been two items that Trump really campaigned on, and I think has a lot of consensus and some bipartisan support. So I expect, you know, within the first month or two, we're going to see some pretty bold legislation that's going to come out of the House and Senate to tackle the border.
Okay. And Jake, you're taking just in terms of affordability. I mean, would that roll in with the tax package, you think, or are there other things that they might be looking at? And
yeah, I think that was definitely something that was, you know, a big issue on the campaign and something that got a lot of attention. They certainly think that, you know, the tax package is the way to do that, at least, you know, initially. And, you know, I think that you could see some returns for you know, most people if they do get that passed, you know, a little extra money in the pocket, that sort of thing. But these are really complicated issues, and we're going to have to see if, you know, the, you know, housing prices are going to come down,
right,
like how they're going to tackle that. And, you know, there's a lot of other things that people are, you know, uncomfortable with.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the things I was just going to mention on inflation and some of the proposals that have come out of the Trump administration and the Trump campaign is he's really looking at tariffs and increasing tariffs on foreign goods, 25% tariff on incoming goods from Mexico, 60% tariff is being discussed on incoming goods from China. So that is a way that he thinks he's going to be able to increase domestic manufacturing, potentially lowering inflation. I know there's a lot of folks in different industries that are very concerned with some of that rhetoric and hope that it's more of a bargaining chip that Trump is putting in place. But those are ways that he's looking to, you know, potentially tackle some of the inflation items. And, you know, that is one area where Congress really will not be in the way of Trump in terms of what he wants to do. They really won't have a say on how he moves forward with that.
All right. We're going to leave it there. Jonathan, Jake, thanks for coming in.
Great.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
The Lobbying Insider is a production of Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron, LLP, New York's premier middle market law firm, practicing in over 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and, of course, government relations. The Lobbying Insider is produced by Joe Benti, and our sound recording engineer is Devante Addison. Publicity by Jody Fisher PR, with Beth Ann Mayer at Lemon Seed Creative managing social media. Our podcast platform manager is Monica Thomas. I'm Zach Fink, host of the podcast, and if you'd like to help us spread the word about our show, please share it with colleagues and friends, and be sure to subscribe on your platform of choice. It can be found on Apple, Audible, Google, iHeart, Podbean, and Spotify platforms. Thanks for joining us.